All right. Well, we've had a conversation.
Yeah.
It's been a good one. We've tried our best to emphasize the pieces that have caused us to do the most thinking. But what's most useful here is that this is a book that is going to be a wonderful tool for rhetoricians in the future. And maybe we could end by going back to Ricardian.
Recursion.
I think so too. A recursion definition of rhetoric.
Yeah, well, he defines it a couple times.
He does.
And uses pretty similar language whenever it comes up. I've got one here at the bottom of 186.
Okay.
See how that goes. He says that he's claimed that rhetoric is a responsive way to reveal the world for others. That sounds kind of positive and friendly, right? We're doing this together. It involves... Great. Yeah.
Makes me care.
Yeah. And what are the means it involves? Well, it involves affective, symbolic, and material means. This is not just symbolic. This is very purposely beyond the symbolic.
Exactly.
And it involves those means in our attempts to reattune or transform how others inhabit the world in a way that leads them to act or not. That sounds like it's kind of on the borderline of persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more than persuasion, right?
I think Rickert would like that, actually, that rhetoric is more on the borderlines of persuasion than persuasion itself. He goes on that next page, 187, to talk about the ways that rhetoric is responsive in a number of ways keyed to language itself.
Hmm.
And again, not just everyday symbolicity, but the rich choreography of background relations that emerge with a culture and give place to the terms we use.
And you emphasized place there, I think, in a really, really important way.
Yeah. He goes on, both symbolicity and the choreographic background emerge through reciprocal relations with other beings, people, culture, and material things. And we're back to Wrigley Field.
Of course.
Yeah.
People, culture, and material things. I mean, like we said, we can't get away from them.
Thinking now, again, back through these ideas that Rickert introduces, the reason that we came to this example was because it didn't have a clear, you know, very easily drawn out meaning behind
yes.
it. Certainly we were changed, certainly we were moved, certainly we were affected in ways that were profound and very memorious. I'll never forget that experience. And this maybe goes back to this idea of what a sonic rhetoric leads us towards.
Yeah.
Are these moments of dissonance and harmony. And this, I guess I like, maybe you can help me riff on this a little bit because I'm riffing here at the end.
No, I like it.
But again, just this idea that the sonic, well, that rhetoric in general operates at this much greater level than the discursive and the symbolic, but that it is indeed embedded within the places that we inhabit, the people that we interact with, the things in our pockets. You know, I have several pictures that night from my phone that I took.
And I think the combination of all of that is part of why we love this study, why we love this field. I mean, both of us are going to be students of music and players of music no matter what area we're in. But I think it's important that we decided to work in rhetoric and to insist that other parts of ourselves, that embodied affect, got invited into it as well.
Exactly.
I think that's why sonic rhetorics are important. It is a reminder of how we can invite everything in more than just words into our lives.
Yeah, well, and just to go off that a little bit, I think that, you know, if you start to look at the ways that that sound scholars are dealing with and in rhetoric, we have folks who do work in music, you know, and Kyle and I tend to be interested in music. I'm interested in archival work and history, but we also have people that are interested in social movements. We have people who are interested in sound and glitch. We have fantastic work coming out on sound and deafness.
Sound art.
And we also have wonderful work in soundscape and kind of embedded sonic environments. All of these, like sound itself is wide open for the kinds of study that are invited by Rickard an ambient approach.
I love that word invited by. We're essentially invited to do this kind of work through this book. It's almost a, hey, please take the next steps. And sound is a clear part of that.
And rather than closing off sonic studies as one kind of rhetorical work, it literally and radically opens it up.
I think that's a good place to end.
I do too.
We'd like to thank Composition Forum for inviting us to do this review. We'd like to thank University of Illinois for allowing us to use this studio to record this in.
Thanks also to Thomas Rickard.
Right.
Yeah, Shure Microphone also. Shure Microphones.
Can I say that John Stone exclusively uses Shure microphones and whatever cymbals.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. And now I need to find a mastering engineer who can make this as loud as possible. We need to enter the loudness wars full throttle, ready to take on the world with the sound.
Yeah. All right, folks. Turn it up. We'll see you next time.
Rock and roll.